From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast to Coast AM. Later on tonight, creatures of all kinds, the scary ones too. Here's what's happening. Republican Donald Trump, Democrat Hillary Clinton regained their stride in the presidential race Tuesday night, winning their respective primaries in New York. That's a big one. And sending a message to their rivals that their campaigns are back on track after recent stumbles. Let's check in with Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. John, first of all, do you agree that their campaigns are back on track?
Well, what I agree, George, is that they never were off track. I've said from day one, as you know, that Trump is the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party, despite people going kicking and screaming, and so is Hillary, and that Bernie, really, you could put a fork in Bernie quite a long time ago. But, you know, this is the exclamation point that everybody's been waiting for with Hillary. And, you know, it's mathematically impossible for Bernie to win this nomination now, even if he's going to continue on, is certainly through next week, where the some of the northeastern states vote. I think the damage that's done to Cruz in this particular primary, New York being one of the most populous states in the country, certainly the epicenter of the financial world, and to be the drubbing that he took, the very poor showing in New York, bodes very unfavorably for Cruz in a general election. Now, what it really means to the Republican Party, for the GOP, not just the anti-Trump movement now that I think is pretty much being laid to rest, but what it really means is that a right-wing candidate like Cruz cannot make it in a general election. What makes it easier for Trump is that he doesn't really fit into the conventional categories, especially the brand of Republicanism that's being espoused by Ted Cruz. So I think the problem going forward is not for Trump, it's really for Hillary. Now, even though this is a very positive sign for Hillary, remember that
she needed this. She had to have this.
She had to have this by a very substantial margin, and she got it. But remember, if this were an open primary, if independents were allowed to vote here in New York, that Bernie might have won this New York primary. Now, the problem for Hillary going forward, and I've said this before, and that's why I've said I've put my neck on the line, basically saying I think that Trump will be the next president of the United States, is because I don't believe that Hillary can pull the vast 40% of independent voters. And the additional problem that she's going to have, George, is the fact that many Bernie supporters, up to 30, maybe 40% of them, are very zealous about Bernie, but they are not likely to vote for Hillary.
Right.
And that's a big change. The idea that she's throwing, you know, I mean, in her acceptance speech tonight over this primary, she said that she would try to unify the party. Well, her only path forward, as I see it, is picking Bernie Sanders as his VP. And there's been no indication yet, and you haven't heard anybody talk about that, but I don't believe that she has a path to the White House without Bernie Sanders being on the ticket.
That's an interesting twist. I'm not sure she's going to name him, John, but you know, we'll see as we move ahead on primaries. It's getting closer, folks. Armed militants in Afghanistan stormed a key government security agency in the capital as part of a coordinated assault, killing at least 28 people, wounding more than 320 people. Goldman Sachs, quarterly profit fell by more than half, and revenue slumped to its lowest in more than 4 years as market volatility hit the Wall Street banks, bond trading, and investment banking businesses. The big store Nordstrom, slashing 400 jobs at its corporate headquarters. The move comes 2 months after the department store chain reported a 3% drop in comparable sales for its fourth quarter and forecast that profit per share would fall 30% in the first half of this year. The cuts confirm a new reality for high-end retailers, that wealthy shoppers are reining in spending, along with the rest of American consumers refusing to pay full price for anything. Well, you know that bank branch on the corner you see, the one on the way to work? they might not be there too much longer. As technology transforms banking like it has so many other sectors, the consequence could be a dramatic decline in the industry's outposts over the next decade. Former Barclays chief executive Anthony Jenkins laid it out in particularly stark terms in a speech, saying that the global industry, under pressure to meet consumer demands for automation and cheaper services, will slash employment and branches by 20 to 50% over the next decade. Catherine Austin Fitz, our registered investment advisor and head of the managing member of the Solari Investment Advisory Services. Well, the internet is getting to banking too, Catherine.
Well, George, you know, as more and more people do things mobile and get comfortable with mobile banking, you're seeing a willingness by the consumer to go to automated solutions. I want no part of it. I always want to know a decision maker at my bank. If you've ever lived through hard times or bad times, you know it pays to know decision makers and have a relationship.
That's right.
More and more people want low fees, and they're going to get it. And when the times get rough, they're going to be sorry.
Well, you know what's doing really well? Small community banks.
Hey, I think this is a great opportunity for the small community banks and credit unions. And I think they're going to pick up market share on this. So, and it's funny, if you look at the mobile strategies now, you know, the small banks can use bigger firms who provide it to lots of smaller banks. And so I bank at the world's smallest community bank, and, you know, my ATM card works all over the world, and I can do mobile, and I can deposit checks by phone and all these different things. So, I think the community banks are really, and the credit unions are going to be very competitive in this environment.
Well, you know, the other thing, too, Catherine, I was at my bank a couple days ago, and they had three tellers there, and the tellers were, you know, all doing what they're doing. They got to be getting paid $35,000 to $45,000 a year,
uh-huh.
and I'm watching them going, there's no way the bank is generating that kind of money to justify those three tellers. Now, in terms of we're concerned, it was convenient, you know, you didn't have to wait in line that long. It was a Friday, but in this particular case, they can't make money this way anymore.
I know. Well, actually, a small community bank can, but I have to tell you, George, I started in the financial world as a teller's assistant. So if we're not going to have any storefront banks, how are all our young people going to get started?
That's a good point. Catherine, check in with us. And what are you doing these days? What's new with you?
George, I'm having a great time. I just published the first quarter wrap-up, and the big theme was where to stash your cash in 2016. Because of all the variability and, of course, the concern of negative interest rates, people are really re-asking the question, where do I stash my cash? And, of course, that's why I love those great community banks, because that's a good place. So check it out at Solari.com.
You got it. Thanks, Catherine. Two pieces of debris recovered from beaches in Mozambique. One found last December, the other in February, almost certainly, they say, came from the missing Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. This according to the Australian Transport Safety Bureau. MH370's disappearance is one of the world's biggest aviation mysteries. The plane vanished from radar on March 8, 2014, en route from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, to Beijing, with 239 people on board. Well, in the future, everyone will get food by manhandling restaurant managers and then stealing a handful of chicken and bacon. So said an Oklahoma City man, 36-year-old Dante Rashad Anderson, who told police when he was arrested for robbery that he comes from a time-traveling moment of 4 years into the future. This is what he said. I am from planet Earth, but I'm 4 years advanced on you, and you guys are always trying to kill me. Anderson is quoted as saying in a police report, on my planet Earth, everyone is dead, and I walked here from there. Well, I think he might need a little help there. 21 anniversary, April 19th, 1995, the tragedy in Oklahoma City, the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. Was it homegrown terrorism? Timothy McVeigh, of course, was charged and executed for that. We'll be back with more on this story on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Now, we have two guests for you for the next couple hours. First of all, Wendy S. Painting, PhD, is a freelance researcher in Western New York. She co-wrote and co-produced the documentary film, A Noble Lie, Oklahoma City, 1995. She also wrote Aberration in the Heartland of the Real, The Secret Lives of Timothy McVeigh, and a yet-to-be-released book called Redacted. Let me say hello to Wendy first. Wendy, welcome to the program.
Hi, George. Thanks for having me. Can you hear me? Thank you.
I sure can, and I'm looking forward to this. Let me also introduce Holland Vanden Neuenhoff, a native of Oklahoma, formerly served in the U.S. Marine Corps as a rifle squad leader. Holland, thank you for serving. His broadcast career started in 2007 as a co-host on Radio Free Oklahoma, later as a co-host on Free Mind Report. He is also the writer and producer of A Noble Lie, Oklahoma City, 1995. Now, that's that full-length documentary examining the Oklahoma City bombing in light of some new evidence that proves that the official story could be a myth. So let's say hi to Holland. Holland, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mr. Norrie. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you for serving, too, by the way, Mr. Marine. I appreciate that.
Thank you very much, sir.
Let's start with you, Wendy, in your involvement in Oklahoma City, this tragedy. What was it that you saw that got you involved in this?
Well, so I was 18 when that happened, and so I took note of it at that time, but and especially because Timothy McVeigh, who was arrested immediately and ultimately executed for as the mastermind of the bombing, he was from about an hour from where I'm from, and so that kind of piqued my attention. You know, how does this boy next door type become this face of terrorism? And I kind of forgot about it for a few years, and I was in college and I was studying literature, and just things kept coming up, and I kept hearing about the case here or there, updates about the case, and I started to look into it, and all I can say is curiosity got me, and so I began to research it, and I would turn in, you know, 5-10 page term papers, and eventually I changed my major altogether to American Studies, and it became the topic of my PhD dissertation. I had access to defense archives, which included letters back and forth from McVeigh to his attorneys, FBI investigation reports, memos going back and forth from the attorneys, all kinds of statements from people that served in the military with McVeigh, letters from his family's friends going back and forth, and this is years prior to the bombing. I also had his medical records at that point, and some of his only... Even his own defense team was only ever able to get partial records for him from the military. And so I was able to see those and then later duplicated those through FOIA. I had access to a lot of FOIA material, Freedom of Information Act. Then later I was given access to private letters he wrote to his biographers prior to his execution, his official biographers. And then given archives, a private collection by a bank robber whose gang of bank robbers was suspected to have been involved with Timothy McVeigh. And through all of these documents, I would pull out names and I would start contacting people and just asking them questions. And I started to build a timeline. The timeline got to be over 300 pages.
Wow.
And eventually became a PhD dissertation. So that's kind of a real quick story. In the middle of that somewhere, or well, closer to the beginning, is when Holland and I met, and he was out in Oklahoma City, and I would be out there speaking with survivors and victims and mm-hmm. victims' family members, eyewitnesses, and he was already involved in looking at the case, and that's when we ended up collaborating on Noble Lie a few years after that.
Okay. And Holland, you, of course, you're from Oklahoma. You were right in the middle of this. Tell us your involvement. I mean, you served in the Marines. All of a sudden, you started questioning. What happened?
Well, Yeah, Oklahoma City was my hometown, so, you know, I want to find out what happened. I was in the Marine Corps when it happened. I just started my Marine Corps career. I was in actually the School of Infantry when I looked up from the chow hall and saw my hometown in the news with a blown-out building. And frankly, at the time of the event, I really didn't pay too much attention. I had a whole lot going on. But as anomalous facts leaked out from the mainstream news and the alternative press and the just burgeoning internet, I paid attention to what was happening. And when I eventually made my way back to Oklahoma City, I decided that I needed to do something about it, and I started collaborating with the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee, headed by State Representative Charles Key, who was looking into the anomalous evidence being suppressed by official authorities. And I started talking to Wendy, and we went on a number of investigative trips across the country, interviewing witnesses, you know, perhaps suspects or collaborators or accomplices. And of course, we collaborated on A Noble Lie, one of the first documentaries that had been done on this subject in a very long time. And for those of you wanting to watch Noble Lie, you can catch it on YouTube. Just look up A Noble Lie, Oklahoma City, and it's a full two-hour documentary. And that will give you, you know, the bulk of the evidence that shows that the government, at the very least, and this is not something to debate, it is lying, according to their own paperwork, about just about every aspect of the bombing.
And, you know, the official story, Wendy and Holland, of course, is that Timothy McVeigh and Nichols were ticked off over the situation at Waco, over the way the government handled that tragedy. And they were just homegrown terrorists. Now, that was the official story. How did that change, Wendy?
Well, that was the official story. Part of what changed is that, you know, there was always, from day one, five different narratives that emerged from what I identified. And these alternate narratives, everything but what you just described, which is generally called, or I call it, the lone wolf narrative, because mm-hmm. Terry Nichols gave him, you know, somehow, but McVeigh's supposed to be the mastermind in this official story. Everybody that saw Timothy McVeigh in Oklahoma City the morning of the bombing, every single eyewitness, and we're talking scores of people, 30, 40 people at least, and there's still reports that are suppressed. Everybody saw him with somebody else. Nobody saw him by himself. And when it came time for the trials, you know, nobody ever, the government never tried to say that Terry Nichols was there that day, and he wasn't. He did have a solid alibi for that morning, but every person saw Timothy McVeigh there, and the family members were, the victim's family members were actually the first people who began asking questions, because obviously they were paying probably the closest attention to the developments, wondering, you know, who had killed their family members. And then they realized also that the surveillance tapes were missing, and they tried to acquire those, as did both defense teams. And that's actually the subject of a current lawsuit right now. And what's called a special master has been appointed to look into, you know, why these tapes have fallen down a memory hole when it's documented that the FBI took possession of them. Now, why are they missing? Well, I mean, if you're going to go by the eyewitnesses, that would be because they show that somebody else was with Timothy McVeigh that day. And while people will say, well, didn't Timothy McVeigh admit, you know, that this was his idea and he did it because he was mad at Waco, I think that one of the things that really was kind of, I don't know, disturbing or strange to me was that in his own, in these records I was telling you about, what I learned was that Timothy McVeigh was telling that story publicly. And he was, as his attorneys noted, he was changing his story to fit with that of the prosecutor. Mm-hmm. In private, Timothy McVeigh was telling very, very different stories. And these range from you know, telling his very first attorneys that he was actually working in undercover operations.
Hold on for a second here, Wendy. We're at the break. We'll be back with both of you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. We're with Wendy Paintine, of course. Her book is called Aberration in the Heartland of the Real, R-E-A-L, and Holland Vanden Nieuwenhoff. His film, along with Wendy's, is called A Noble Lie. And, of course, we're talking about both we have now approached the 21st anniversary of that tragedy, in which well over 160 people died in that tragedy, April 19th, 1995. Gosh, it's hard to believe, Holland, 21 years, isn't it?
Yes. I guess time has flown, but then again, so many things have happened since then also. But in those years, it's not so long of a time, and it's long enough for people who do know things are coming forward, you know, more than ever. They weren't coming forward when the event was so fresh in people's minds and the case was unresolved and they felt that people were scared about it. But people are still coming forward with information. And if you have any information, please contact Wendy at lonewolfresearch.com. That's lonewolfresearch.com. She has a contact link there. And we are still soliciting tips, and we follow up on them as much as possible, which is as much as you know, we can. So please, if you're listening out there, I know, George, you have a tremendous, huge audience out there listening. And we've picked up so many tips since we've been releasing our work that one of the main goals of this, and I know Wendy's is too, is to let people out there who know things that people are researching them and following up, and your knowledge is not in vain. So please contact Wendy at lonewolfresearch.com. And lay it on us.
Now, in McVeigh's biography, his biographers Lou Michael and Dan Herbeck wrote that McVeigh, in essence, confessed to being the mastermind and the principal in bombing in there. He says that McVeigh admitted that he did not think that there were children in the building. He didn't think there was a daycare center. Nichols refutes that and says, no, we both knew and we didn't care. But Holland, are you saying, and Wendy, are you saying that McVeigh was not involved in this, or what are we saying here?
Absolutely not. That's not what we're saying. I don't know that actually Nichols said that they both knew that there were children there, but you're right that Timothy McVeigh did tell his biographers that, and he told you know, people that, and that was his public story. And every document I have mentioned in this book, I actually have physical copies of these. He had been telling a very different story privately for a long time, and a few different stories, actually. And I guess I'd like to kind of, because we've talked about that official story, and just to put it in context for your audience, I'd just like to go down very quickly, if you don't mind, the five different narratives that have been told about.
Sure, please.
All right. So we've got what you said is the McVeigh as mastermind with help from Nichols, and that's the lone wolf version, and that's where McVeigh alone comes up with this idea, plans it, and gets some help during the preparation stage. But he alone drives up to the rider, he alone drives up in a rider to the Murrah Building on April 19th, 1995. Then the next story would be the Pack of Wolves story. And this was the one that was initially told by the eyewitnesses, victims, family members, even journalists in the beginning. And that's where McVeigh has a lot more help from anywhere from 3 to 8 people, depending on who's telling the story, but the identities of these people cumulatively are called John Doe 2, and they get away, and McVeigh takes the fall. The third story is called the Pack of Wolves, and the Pack of Watched Wolves, and that's where you've got this larger group of people. However, they're being monitored by informants and intelligence agents in the lead up to the bombing.
And they knew it was going to happen, and they let it happen, I guess.
Yes, for whatever reason. And there's, you know, that story kind of branches off. You could, you, It's been said that it just got out of control and it got out of hand, or, you know, and that ranges to they let it happen. And that one has gained credibility because since McVeigh's execution, documents have been released showing that there were warnings by informants saying down to the day and time and the exact building that was going to be blown up. And those were, I guess you might say, overlooked. Then the next story is what I identify as the guilty agent story, and that's where McVeigh himself is this undercover operative. There's, you know, different variations on that. Either he goes rogue or he's still acting in that capacity up to the moment of the bombing. And then finally, the last story, and this one is the most bizarre sounding, is the experimental wolf. And that one kind of goes into the Manchurian candidate type. Stories. And, you know, again, there's different variations on that. Now, McVeigh himself told all of these stories. He told his first attorney that, like I said, he had been recruited to work in an undercover capacity. He had told that to his family members and to friends. He began telling that story while he actually was still in the Army, before the bombing was even, you know, before Waco happened.
Yeah, he was a Gulf War veteran.
That's right. And actually, my book follows him. It goes, it's taking his words, but also the words of the men he was with in his company that were with him. And it pretty much follows him hour to hour in the Gulf War. But another thing that he told his attorneys and other people was that he had been given experimental shots. He had been, and he was sick. And when you look at his medical records, he's got 75 visits to dentists and doctors in a 2.5 year span of time in active duty military service. And that's excluding the portion of the records that were missing. Now, those visits, first of all, that's an unheard of number.
I don't think I've been to the doctor in my lifetime that many times.
No, exactly. Then it doesn't stop there, though, because he gets out and he's going to the VA on a regular basis. He's continuing these appointments up until the bombing, and then afterwards he's being seen by a physician on a regular basis. Now, there's a couple of different ways, I think, to interpret those records. But that's the that's part of the experimental story, where you have this sick McVeigh. The other thing is that people say, well, he was found sane and fit to stand trial, and that's also true. However, there was a team of psychologists and psychiatrists that were visiting him in prison after his arrest, and they diagnosed him with dissociative identity disorder, which is a really interesting, mental health label. Sure. But it used to be called multiple personality disorder.
Well, and so, I think, Wendy, that anybody who commits any kind of heinous crime, any kind, whether it's a child abduction or a murder, a planned murder, I think they're all off kilter somewhere. There's something wrong with them. Normal people don't do this.
Absolutely. Yeah, right? There has to be, you would think. And certainly, but what the public was told, and I guess what my point is that what the public was told was, you know, and what McVeigh would have liked to have, you know, been his legacy, was that he was found perfectly fine. You know, this was a rational act, not a good act, not a moral act, but a rational act by a sane person. So I think that the records certainly show otherwise, but the defense team themselves, or, you know, the defense team was highly compartmentalized. And so certain portions of the defense team right from the beginning were looking into this theory that he had been mind controlled. And those stories, you know, they're fun, but they're also very disturbing. And there's oddly evidence there that opens up room for that type of an interpretation.
Okay, Holland, when we talk about in your documentary, A Noble Lie, tell us about that title, because that tells me a lot.
Well, noble lie is from Plato's Republic, and it means a myth or untruth told by the elite to preserve their position or the greater good of society as they see it. It's a white lie told for the greater good. And that reflects the method of the cover-up in Oklahoma City and the compartmentalization of the cover-up. Whatever the final scenario may have been, what we do know is that the FBI and other associated federal law enforcement agencies were covering up what most of them thought was a gummed-up sting operation. We know for a fact that McVeigh was under surveillance, that he was in contact with federal informants who were infiltrating the far right and the militia movement at that time. We have interviewed targets of the surveillance efforts who actually believed that McVeigh was a cop himself because of the way he acted, because he was hanging out with known informants and he was behaving as one. He was already called out as one. Basically, McVeigh and a small cohort of Confederates was pitching the Oklahoma City script to various right-wing groups across the country. And by that time, as one related to us, basically all the dumb guys had already been picked up in sting operations and mm-hmm. no one was biting.
Okay. When we look at the five scenarios that Wendy just outlined, Holland, you first, of those five scenarios of what could have happened, which one do you think is the possibility?
What can be proven to a fact is that McVeigh was being surveilled and target of government law enforcement operations. We have paper on that. By name, they were looking for him. This is contrary to what the government says when they say they never heard of Tim McVeigh until the first day he was ever arrested in his life, which was the afternoon of the bombing when he was speeding away in a car without a license plate.
Which was pretty stupid, by the way, for him to do.
Pretty stupid. Yeah. And one can never rule out stupidity in solving quandaries. So that can be proven that he was affiliated and or being surveilled by law enforcement. I believe it does go deeper than that myself. As Colonel Roger Charles, an award-winning journalist who worked on this case and helped produce the infamous special on ABC 2020, the second one was canceled on request of the Justice Department.
Right.
But he said that for every black op, there's a white op. And that means that black undercover operations utilize existing operations for movement of resources, funds, and so forth, and to provide cover. It's for security. And that they always piggyback on other operations. I believe that, and as Wendy has uncovered in her book, that this, the Oklahoma City bombing was probably spawned out of an operation called PACCON, Patriot Conspiracy. This is a name the government gave to an operation to infiltrate every right-wing and militia and neo-Nazi group in the United States in the early to mid-1990s. It continued to the late 90s and continues in some way today, of course, probably under a different name. But PACCON operatives were running around. McVeigh was hanging out with them. We believe that Andreas Strassmeyer, who was, in all likelihood, he basically admitted it himself. He did admit it himself to a journalist that he was an agent provocateur, that he did not expect the building to collapse, or that they did not expect that the truck to pull up when there were people inside the building. It appears this was, in my mind, a publicity stunt. State Representative Charles Key, who ran the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee asking questions, was briefed in secret by a Senate staffer from one of the Oklahoma senators. And he said they had been briefed, the staffer and the senator from Oklahoma had been briefed by the Justice Department that the Oklahoma City operation was a sting gone bad. And that's what can be proven. I believe it is deeper, that the sting was turned on the FBI. They have to protect it. They have to cover it up themselves because it's their operation. But I think someone hijacked our operation, made it go live, and the Secret Service, I mean the FBI and the ATF had to cover it up themselves because it was their people. In fact, it was probably their bomb because we know McVeigh and Nichols did not construct one in Kansas. So that is where we are pursuing the investigation. But as in Wendy's book, she lays out, the evidence in Oklahoma City is so deadly to the official story. There are very few cases where just by the government's paperwork alone, it is so easy to prove that they are lying through their teeth.
And Wendy, how about you then, in terms of these five scenarios? Go ahead.
I would like to say that the book itself, it does go into everything that Holland just said, and it goes into all the other scenarios we discussed, that the point of the book, the objective, and the objective of my studies were to take these stories and with the documentation I had and with the people I had talked to, but mainly with the documentation, to try to start to separate, you know, what's legend, what's rumor, what's fact, what's fiction, and what's fantasy, you know, and because there are some really entertaining but speculative stories that floated around on the internet and that continue to, but most of the time they're not supported by anything. And, you know, so in that way, it's almost just like the government story where, you know, there's nothing backing these up. What I was able to find sometimes shows that what people think to be fact.
And Wendy, I need you to talk right into the phone because you're kind of muddy.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. You know, the book itself, it explores and kind of tests all these stories, and it tests stories about medical experimentation and mad scientists, implantable tracking microchips, which is a story that a lot of people, I think, are familiar with when they think about Tim McVeigh. There's doppelgangers, where to the point where McVeigh himself is looking at the evidence and saying, are there doubles of me running around? And his own defense attorneys are questioning that, as is the FBI, briefly considering the possibility that there's someone impersonating him using his name. And again, I am not saying that he's innocent. That is not what I'm saying, because I undoubtedly think that he is guilty, but I also think that it goes a little bit deeper than this. So the book explores all of that. And unfortunately, I don't know why you didn't get our talking points, but there are some more interesting elements to the story that concern Area 51 and microchips. I don't know if you want
I was
to go
no,
into that.
No. I was saving that for next hour.
Okay. I can say this, that I agree with Holland that it's undoubtedly, I firmly believe, and I could pull out documents right now, that there is a watched wolf scenario going on here. There was one of the lead FBI agents that ran this PatCon operation himself has, there are emails that have been released that have been entered into court cases saying, we were watching McVeigh at these paramilitary camps, because what McVeigh was doing was running around to radical groups on the right, radical groups, and going in there and making a network of friends, which is what he was telling his family his mission was, and gathering evidence on them. And so we do have documentation that they were at least watching him in the lead up. Now, I given the medical records, given the military records, given the statements I have by not just himself, because he is obviously a questionable source, he can't tell a straight story, but when you have other people with no reason to lie backing up some of the stranger stories he's talking about, then I do start to think there's, you know, an experimental wolf type of a
story. You know, he got executed, based on the time that people are alive before they get executed. He got executed pretty darn fast. And I always wondered why. Yes, this was a tragedy. It was horrible. 168 people died. But they seemed to want him dead quickly. Any reason for that?
He helped to speed up that execution. He went along with it. He also sued so that there could be no autopsy of his body. He did that successfully.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about that when we come back. And we're going to get into this other bizarre area of Area 51, UFOs, and how does that fit into this story? We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.